by thanking everybody for participating and the healthcare professionals who are here. I want to thank you for everything that you're doing, literally saving lives. I want to thank the Nussbaum family for dedicating the General Medical Halacha and Ethics series of my Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. And I thank all the people who contacted me about these issues and asked for having a class and informed the thinking that I bring to the table on this. A few notes of preface here. First of all, I know that I don't need to say this because you've all heard it from me before, but nonetheless, nothing I say here should be intended, it should be taken, I should say, as psak, as a halachic ruling. These are questions that really require a serious posek, someone who's going to give real, real practical guidance. I think that people who have practical questions and have access to a posek, to a serious halachic authority, should ask that person. Otherwise, they should ask their shul rabbi, who should take the question there. We're talking about matters that are literally life and death. You're investing your lives to save the rest of the community. At the same time, my tendency is to be glib sometimes. And so I'm apologizing in advance if anything I say comes across as glib. It's certainly not intended to be. I just realized I didn't start recording yet, so I'm going to start recording the session now. And I'll post the recording online if all goes well. I wanted to provide text in particular as background on these cases, so I'm limiting a little bit the range of cases we're going to discuss. And the way I like to manage the questions is by specifically addressing questions at particular points during the session, as opposed to in an ongoing way. There's a phrase in Aramaic, Karyana de Igrisa Iule Hebe Parvanka. And what it means is that the one who reads out the scroll is the one who should carry it out. And what that means in practice is if you have a good idea, then you should be the one to actually execute it. So Barry suggested that we should have somebody monitor the chat and be the one to read out the questions that people enter into the chat. So Barry, at various times when I pause and ask for the questions, I'll ask you to read out whatever's written into the chat. Thank you very much for being volunteered. I apologize for having to limit the questions. It's not a great way to learn, but in this case, it's necessary in order to cover our material. If you look at the source sheet, which I put into the chat, you'll see at the top of the sheet links for two important recordings. These are for talks that were given last week, right before Pesach. The first one, by Dr. Avram Steinberg, via Torah in Motion, was on April 5th. And you can actually find the recording there. You do have to register on the site. The other one is from Rav Asher Weiss and was done via Agudas Yisrael of America on April 6th. Didn't put the date on there, but that's when it was. And that's a video that's available freely on online. Both of them were addressing questions regarding the COVID-19 issues. I'm going to be quoting them from time to time during the during our session this evening. I'm also drawing on material from Rav Herschel Schachter at times. All the sources on the sheet, unless I missed any, are presented in the original Hebrew as well as my English translation, with two notable exceptions. One, Rav Schachter chose to publish his tshuva on ventilator triage in Hebrew. And whereas he's been translating all of his other responsa on coronavirus issues into English, he chose not to translate that one, so I decided to leave that in Hebrew. So where I quote that, I just left that in the original Hebrew, although I will explain it in our session. And then the other is the Rambam's, the quote from the Guide of the Perplexed, the Mara Nevuchim, is not in the original because the original is Arabic, and that's not really going to help me much. But otherwise, all the sources on our sheets are Hebrew and English. Okay. So you see on the sheet the three basic questions that I want to address. And the first one is the one that we're going to start with, but they're basically dealing with, first of all, the issue of endangering oneself or one's family in order to treat others. That's your first question. Your second one here is ventilator triage, as well as the issue of splitting a ventilator between patients, something that is relatively new on the scene, but there's a lot of literature about right now because of concern for ventilator shortages. And then the third, the issue of issuing DNRs in order to save the staff, the healthcare professionals, when there is concern that performing CPR could actually expose them to virus particles. There's more complexity in each of these cases that we'll see. Now, because I had multiple requests, I'm also adding a fourth piece to this, which, God willing, we'll do at 9 o'clock after we do all the other three, which is, as I mentioned in today's email, the issue of experimental treatments. There's a lot going around about various treatments, and we'll talk more about them when we get to this. And the question of, from a halachic perspective, is it appropriate to try things which have not been proven through the usual clinical trials and so on. So that's going to be, God willing, an addendum at the end for those who are able to remain. If people need to leave at some point, obviously, you know, go ahead. All right. So we start with the issue of endangering oneself in order to treat others. So we actually dealt with this topic at length in a session back in November, December. Or maybe it was September. No, it was September, sorry. On blood and live organ donation, I gave a link in source number one on the sheet to where you can find that online. What we're doing in this section about endangering oneself in order to treat others comes from the discussion about donating organs in order to help others, potentially at one's own risk. So the general debate is this. The duty to protect one's life and person is well established. Right? The Torah prohibits taking one's own life. The Gemara in Bava Kamma, Tzadi Yomid Beis, talks about Chovel Ba'atzmo, you're not allowed to wound yourself. The Rambam talks about the obligation to protect your health. These are well-established facts within Judaism. The duty to save other people's lives is also well-established within Judaism. I brought you in source number two on the sheet, the classic Gemara on Velo Samot Al Dam Reyacha, you are not allowed to stand by while other people's blood is shed. I have to save people's lives. I may even be required to save their wealth, depending on how you understand the implications of this mitzvah. In addition to Velo Samot Al Dam Reyacha, not to stand by while people's blood is shed, we also have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. Somebody's property is in danger. It's lost. We have an obligation to try to restore it to them. We also have a mitzvah, Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. So all of these, and frankly even if, some additional sources, militate towards intervening in order to help others, so much so the Gemara in Yuma Daf Pehe says that saving lives overrides Shabbos, and we have the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, saving a single life is like saving the entire world. There is a great imperative to save others. So what do I do when, on the one hand, the imperative to protect my own life, and then the other hand, the imperative to save the lives of others, what do I do when these two imperatives are pitted against each other? Now what do I do? So normally, the answer seen in many sources is you have to protect yourself. And risk is in fact prohibited. So that I brought you several passages of Gemara that supports this. You take a look at source number three on the sheet. That's a classic. It's the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Samach Beis, Amud Aleph, the story of the two Jews who are walking in the wilderness. Right? Two people are walking in the wilderness. They only have enough water for one of them, and that water is in the possession of one of these two people. If they both drink, they will die. Obviously, this is a hypothetical case. How in the world do they know that this is a fact? Nonetheless, these two people have been trapped in the wilderness since the days of the Gemara, and they've been living with these parameters. So those are the parameters. That's the case. they know that they can't share the water. One of them can drink and live, or they both die. And first, Ben Petura says, better for both of them to drink and die. Don't let one of them watch the other one die. Rabbi Akiva says, no, it's not true. Yes, you have to save the lives of others, but with your own life. Your life comes first. That's the principle put forth by Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara in Bava Metzia. You save yourself first. We also have a Gemara in Nida, which I brought you in source number 4, in which people come to Rabbi Tarfon and they say, the government has accused us of murder. Please, you have to help us. You should hide us. And he says, I don't know what to do. If I don't hide you, they're going to catch you. But if I hide you, you know, there is a principle in Halacha that that you're not allowed to accept Lashon Hara, but you do have to be worried about it. Maybe it's true. Maybe you really are murderers. I can't hide you. So he says, go hide yourselves. He is concerned for his own health, for his own welfare. And then the third example, which I'll take a little more time on in source number 5, is the Gemara in Nedarim. Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. In general, I'm going to be reading out only the English in these sources rather than the Hebrew and English, just in the interests of time. But the Gemara tells the following story. There's a spring that's owned by a certain town. It runs from one town to the other. And there's a choice between the lives of the people in the town at the start of the spring, meaning they have access to it and they would use the water for their lives. However, the people downstream also need the water. So the rule is, their lives come before those of others. They drink from the spring and save their own lives. They don't have to worry about the people who are downstream. What if it's their animals versus the animals of the town downstream? Again, their own animals come first. Their laundry versus the laundry of the people downstream. Once again, their laundry comes before that of others. If there's a choice between the lives of others and their laundry, so it's either we upstream want to be able to do laundry, or the people downstream want to have drinking water, the rule is that the lives of others precede their laundry. That's the Tanakhama. That's the first position. Give other people water to drink instead of hoarding it so that you can use it for your laundry. But then along comes Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yossi says, actually, no. He says, the laundry of the people upstream takes precedence over the lives of the people downstream. Your water, it's your water, and therefore you're allowed to use it for the sake of your own laundry. Now, there's a lot to be discussed as to Rabbi Yossi's position. Why in the world would he put your laundry first? Is it really that the people downstream are going to perish if they don't have access to the water? And Rabbi Yossi will say, well, too bad, I want clean laundry. That's really a bigger discussion, but I wanted to show this to you here because Rabbi Yossi's position is so strong, and even the Tanakhama, the initial view is your life precedes the life of the people in the next town, the town downstream. All of these sources militate for saying the people upstream come first, the people with the resources come first. We do have some sources, on the other hand, that seem to allow endangering oneself in order to take care of others. One is a bizarre Gemara in Ksuvos, in source number 6, in which three chachamim, three sages, Amemar, Marzutra, and Ravashi, are sitting at the entrance of the palace of King Izgur, and the butler is passing by with some of the king's food, and Ravashi sees Marzutra's face turn pale, two of the sages, Ravashi and Marzutra. Ravashi sees Marzutra's face turn pale, meaning pale with hunger. And he takes some of the food with his finger and he puts it in Marzutra's mouth. And the butler says to him, you stuck your finger in the king's food. You have ruined the king's feast. And they said to him, like, why in the world did you do that? And he said, I did it in order to ruin the king's food. And they said to him, what in the world are you talking about? And he says to them, well, I saw that there was poison in there. I saw leprous pork in there. The king's men check and they don't find any. And he points to it and says, look, check over here. And they checked and they found it. And he thereby solves the problem of Marzutra apparently being in danger from his hunger. By giving him food, and on the other end he gets away with it because somehow he gets a miracle and the king's food is shown to be either either defective or outright bad for the king. Can't be poisonous, because then again, you know, how does Marzutra survive it? But he gets a miracle, basically. The read of this Gemara, which again, I'm going through fairly quickly, but the read of this Gemara in source number 6 is that Rav Ashi sees that Marzutra is in danger because of his hunger. And in order to help Marzutra, he endangers himself. He gets bailed out by a miracle, but he endangers himself in order to save Marzutra. So it would seem that you are indeed allowed to endanger yourself to save others. The truth of the matter is that there are various ways that this story is explained away, such as Rav Ashi was close to the government and he knew that he could get away with it, or that Rav Ashi expected to have a miracle. There are all sorts of different explanations for this story to try to get away from the implications of it. But if you take a look at source number 7, it's a little more clear that indeed one would be allowed to endanger oneself in order to take care of others. Rabbi Isi was captured in a dangerous area. Rabbi Yonasan said, let the corpse be wrapped in its sheet. He says, there's nothing we can do. Rabbi Isi is dead. There's nothing, there's no way we're going to be able to do anything about it. And Reish Lakish says, I will kill or I will be killed. I'll go save him by force. And then, of course, he goes and negotiates, and that way ends up saving the life of Reish Lakish. He doesn't actually end up using force, and they return him. But Reish Lakish seems willing to endanger himself in order to save others. So some read this story and say, well, not so fast. Reish Lakish has what could be called a special set of skills. Right? Reish Lakish grew up had an early career as a bandit. He is a dangerous man in his own right, and therefore he can do what others cannot, and therefore he's not really endangering himself in this circumstance. And that's indeed what some suggest. However, others argue that this is in fact a debate between the sources that we saw before, which were Babylonian Talmud, except for source number 6, but the sources that preceded that, so sources number 3, 4, 5, were the Babylonian Talmud position of don't endanger yourself. And then on the other end, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud in source number 7, is saying, no, you can endanger yourself in order to save others. And the fundamental question is whether the mitzvah of Velo Samot Al Dam Reyacha, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed, actually warrants, permits or warrants, endangering yourself. That is, according to many, what this is all about. Indeed, there's even debate regarding the position taken by the Rambam. If you take a look at source number 8, the Rambam speaks of the mitzvah of saving others. Look what he says. He says, and I underlined and bolded the key words, one who can save and does not rescue, violates you shall not stand by as the blood of your peer is shed. Also, one who sees another drown at sea or attacked by bandits or a wild beast, and who could save him personally or by hiring people to rescue him, and he does not do so, violates you shall not stand by as your brother's blood is shed. So the Rambam twice says, one who can save, kol hayachol lahatzil, or v'yachol lahatzilo, somebody who could save. So that seems to indicate that the mitzvah of saving is specifically where you have the ability to save others. So that there is a debate as to what the Rambam's position is. The Bach of Yol Circus, writing in the 17th century, thought that the tour of Yaakov Bal HaTurim, a principal author of Halacha, believed that the Rambam is saying, don't risk your life. Others disagree, including the Bach himself, and says that no, that's not what the Rambam actually meant. The Rambam thinks that you would indeed risk your life in order to save others. So we have a classic debate brewing here. Is the imperative to save others sufficient to warrant endangering yourself? In practice, many halachic authorities say that one should enter into a low risk in order to save the life of another person. That's the way that it is viewed. So take a look, for example, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein in source number 9 on the sheet is one example. He says, the authority cited from the Jerusalem Talmud that one must enter danger, and the early authority, meaning they take the view that you do enter danger, the early authorities omitted it, because our Babylonian Talmud make clear one need not put himself into this danger, but all is case specific. One should weigh the matter carefully and not be too protective of oneself. He says, you know, we have a general rule, Babylonian Talmud versus Jerusalem Talmud. If they disagree with each other, we follow the Babylonian Talmud. But he says, don't be too protective of yourself. You have to be willing to take some risk on behalf of others. And there's a lot of literature on this. I brought you the Radbaz in source number 10. We dealt with his case in the organ donation discussion. I'm not really sure why I brought it here. I might have just cut and pasted it from that sheet by accident, honestly. But that's an example of another example of someone taking this position that you do take small risks for the sake of others, you don't take big risks. And I gave you a link in source number 11. Rabbi Shlomo Brody put out an article in Mosaic last week in which he presented a history of how this has been applied in times of plague specifically. So it's a worthwhile read. But now I want to go back to the question that we're asking here, because I realize that I didn't read the vignette out loud, and that's worthwhile. Not everybody has the source sheet in front of them. So here's our question. Sarah, an emergency room physician, saved up vacation time for months in advance to be able to be off for the first days of Pesach. All vacations have now been canceled, but her husband insists that she should be absentee. He argues that her first obligations are to herself and her family, and the hospital knew she wasn't scheduled to work on those days. What should Sarah do? That's the question here, which introduces some complications. And again, if we were doing this normally, then I would ask you, what are the complications in this scenario? But because of the limitations of doing it this way, I'm going to say what I see as the complications here. So number one, she's a healthcare worker. And being a healthcare worker puts a person in a different class when it comes to endangering oneself for a few reasons. First of all, the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg, major authority in medical halacha at the end of the 20th century, noted that being a healthcare worker may present two reasons why you should endanger yourself. It's a little bit out of order on the sheet. Jump to number 13. I'm going to come back to number 12 momentarily. But he says, being a healthcare worker presents two reasons why one would be allowed to endanger oneself. He says, first of all, number 13, it appears to me that one could say this regarding a doctor. Since it is standard that the doctor who knows diseases and ailments provides necessary aid, and without this, there will be great devastation for the ill and the healthy. Therefore, he is acting in a standard way for the normal function of the world, and the risk involved in treating the sick is not considered introducing oneself into forbidden risk. In other words, he says, this isn't called high risk if you're a healthcare professional. This is normal risk for healthcare professionals, is one argument that he brings. He says, we judge the level of risk based on who you are and what your circumstances are. That's number one. Number two, he says, you could lose your living if you're not going to endanger yourself. He says, it further appears, in my humble opinion, that since the doctor does this to treat the sick for a living, he is permitted to introduce himself into possible danger for this. It's like the way the Torah permitted a worker to enter danger for his livelihood. So if I go climbing on a scaffold, that's dangerous. If a construction worker does it, that's what he does for his parnasa. That's what he does for his living. So the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg contends that a healthcare worker has two reasons to be able to take special risks that others would not. This is normal risk for a healthcare worker, and also it's for their parnasa. He has more material there. Obviously, I'm just cherry-picking elements of it. However, beyond the position of Rav Waldenberg, there are those who argue that it's obligatory for a healthcare worker to be willing to take greater risk. And that's for two reasons. Number one, when you're dealing with a case in which knowledge and skill are only available to a limited population, that automatically creates a greater obligation. The Shulchan Aruch, which is back in number 12, says, the Torah permitted a doctor to heal, and it is a mitzvah, and part of saving lives. One who refrains is spilling blood. If you have the ability, if you have special abilities that aren't found in the general population, that creates a greater obligation. That's the argument of Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch. So that's one reason why there may be a greater obligation. You have greater abilities than others. And then the other point is, you're saving the community. It's not about saving one person here, one life versus one life. It's one life versus an entire community. It's what we call Hatzalah Derabim, like the justification that's brought for Esther to endanger herself to go to Ahasuerus. Rav Asher Weiss made this point in his session on April 6th that I referenced in source number 15. I gave you the minute marks of the recording so you could look it up yourself. For those who joined us late, in the beginning of the sheet, I gave you the link for where you could find the recordings. But Rav Asher Weiss said, society needs people who will take certain risks, like police, like firefighters, like healthcare workers. And he says, a Torah-based society, imagine if you created a situation in which a Torah-based society now had to make decisions about having police or firefighters or healthcare workers. You wouldn't suddenly do away with all these people. They're necessary for society. And he argued that that's true based on the Shulchan Aruch, which I brought you in source number 14. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, talks about judges and says that public judges are obligated to handle cases, even if those cases involve tough litigants who potentially pose a threat. And the reason why the judge is obligated to do so is because society needs to have dayanim. Society needs to have justice, not necessarily to enter immediate and great danger, but to be able to accept certain levels of danger. So Rav Asher Weiss contended that as well. And Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, in source number 15, I gave you the reference in his talk, also says it's at least optional, if not obligatory. Now, this assumes that there's proper PPE. This assumes that there's proper protective equipment involved here for the medical professionals, not that they're putting themselves into the position where they're going to be in danger. And that's something that I'm going to come back to in a little bit. I see that the questions are building here in the chat, so maybe it's time to pause. And just take those. We haven't gotten to some of the complications yet in our vignette. Specifically, for example, the fact that the family members are opposing participating and how that affects things. So we're going to come back to that shortly. But let's see what we have here. Barry, I don't need to make you read. I have the chat here and I can read it. Yeah. Okay, so the first question here, what if I'm a physician with a relatively low-risk role, say a psychiatrist who can see patients via video? Can I volunteer to help out in the COVID assessment center or the ER? So if I understand the question here is, you're already involved doing something that is low-risk. You want to help out in a more high-risk area. Is that, Tippi Cohen is the name on this. Tippi, is that what you're talking about? She says yes. Okay. So, volunteering to go into a higher-risk situation. So, number one, I would assume you're talking about where you have the medical abilities to actually function in a higher-risk area. Right, because I don't know what the ability of the psychiatrist is to help out in the ER. I imagine it depends on when they did their medical training, but they're
willing to retrain people or to redeploy.
Right. So from what we've said so far, it sounds like it would be permissible to do so. Not obligatory, but it sounds like it would be permissible based on what we're saying. Yes. if you're relatively low risk, and in terms of yourself, also you're low risk. We're not talking about somebody who's in one of the categories that have been identified as being more vulnerable. It would sound like this would be a permissible thing to do. The is Sicily Ezer, laser asks, is Sicily Ezer describing usual infectious issues may not apply in a pandemic? You can make that argument. That's a fair question regarding the Sicily Ezer. If all I had to go on was the Sicily Ezer, then I think that you could say that's not necessarily in a pandemic situation. And it's not in the context of his original tshuva, his original responsum. But because you have these other arguments, I feel comfortable extending it further. What if working as an HCP, healthcare professional, then puts your family at risk, i.e. a physician is also a caregiver to an elderly parent or has family that's immunocompromised? So I'm going to come back to that shortly. It's a very important question, and it's part of where I want to go with this. So hold that thought. And then Jack asks, what are the ethics of saving others if in doing so you risk notably your own life but the lives of an innocent third party? So I'm going to come back to that. Amaris, what additional considerations need to be taken for the pregnant healthcare worker, if any? So there, from a halachic perspective, there is the question of endangering the child or endangering the mother who, is supposed to be birthing and taking care of the child. But it's also a medical question, clearly. And I don't know the answer to that medically. And I'm actually not going to ask the doctors to weigh in because we have an awful lot of healthcare professionals here. And I worry about the result of that. If anybody wants, though, you can see Amaris's name on there if you want to send her information about pregnancy and risk. That maybe that would be helpful. What about working in an environment with inadequate PPE? I'm coming back to that question. Please define low risk. Is it a percentage? This is really, really hard. I had a note here which I skipped in my notes. Some sources try to define small risk. Some float the idea that 10% constitutes a low risk. Others suggest it's what normal people are willing to endure as risk in the course of their lives. I have yet to see anybody come up with a good number. I am in the camp of Rav Asher Weiss in general when it comes to statistics on these things, which is to not really trust saying, well, 15% yes and 16% no, or something along those lines. I find that very difficult to work with, to try to go on that basis. I don't know of a good number. I have yet to see a good number. Okay, so let's get back to our vignette and see what we can do with it. And yes, Albert, I accept that risk differs for each of us. I think that's true. What about our case? Family members oppose participating. So they, we've said that you have to be concerned about your own health, and halacha tends to view you as autonomous with the ability to make decisions independently. Halacha also assumes, though, that we consult family. Rav Moshe Feinstein famously discussed this when discussing the wishes of an unconscious patient and who could determine what it is that the unconscious patient wants. And he writes, Igros Moshe Choshen Mishpat Beis Ayin Dalet, that we normally do consult family. Further, certain family members have unique claims to be consulted. So parents, for example, right? There's kibud av v'aim, there's honoring parents. However, there's a limit on what parents can demand of their child in this regard. So that Rav Zilberstein, talking about organ donation, says that parents do not have the right to oppose a child's decision to donate a kidney where that is considered low risk for the child. The parents can object, but the child is indeed entitled to ignore the objection of the parent. But what about a spouse? So the spouse situation is really interesting because spouses have claims on each other, whether that is in terms of the their physical relationship and they have claims on each other in that way, or whether it's the financial relationship, the husband's financial obligation that he accepted upon himself with the ketubah that he is going to support his wife, so much so that halakhic authorities tend to say, when it comes to organ donation, that in the event that there's a fear of interruption of the relationship due to the organ donation, meaning physical relationship, meaning his ability to work and to support her, if it's the wife who's protesting, that they actually are indeed able to protest a decision like that. I brought it in source number 16 from Rabbi Zilberstein. He says, even if the donor's wife opposes his donation, it is pious to donate. And if it would cause divorce, perhaps he is not obligated to lose both his kidney and his wife for the sake of a pious activity. Even when the donor's parents oppose the donation, it is pious to donate. I thought that was an interesting way to frame the issue. But in terms of our discussion, not organ donation, but endangering oneself here, it's very hard for me to think that in our case, a spouse could force a healthcare worker to leave her job. Especially if it's the vignette that I gave, where it's not about a health risk, it's about, I want you home for Yontif. In practice, given the obligation to the job and the weight of the community's need for healthcare workers, I have a hard time thinking that a spouse could object just on the basis of Yom Tov and force the other spouse to stay home. However, where you're dealing with a health risk, then it's a different story. Rav Asher Weiss, in his Zoom that I gave you the link for in the beginning, as well as in his Minchas Asher Corona, for those who didn't see this, Rav Asher Weiss has now issued a book of his tshuvos, his responsa, as well as special other writings related to the pandemic. And it's available if anybody wants it. Maybe I'll send it out later on, or maybe I'll upload it into the chat now so that people can have it. It's fascinating. Let me see if I can find it quickly, then I'll do that. But it's not, oh, there it is. Okay, so I just uploaded it to the chat, so you can download it there. It's about 100 pages. So in there, in Simon Hay, he talks about this case as well, the case in which a medical professional has a spouse who has multiple sclerosis. And the concern is that if the medical professional were to contract the virus, they could end up giving it to their spouse and endangering their spouse. And there, Rav Asher Weiss says, you don't have the right to risk the health of your spouse. He says that you can't do. In the event that there is somebody who's high risk within the household, that changes the calculation. And he says the community will have to rely on other healthcare professionals. It's not up to you to be, you know, we talk about Mesiris Nefesh. This is now me talking and not his words. But we talk about Mesiris Nefesh, about being willing to give one's life for others. That's great, but you can't give other people's lives for others. That's not the same thing. Okay. What about, still within this case, postponing the start of treatment in order to put on PPE, to put on protective gear? So this question was raised in a Globe and Mail article that I brought you in source number 17 about the fact that by the time you get all suited up, it could be too late for the patient. We have said that healthcare professionals may be permitted or even obligated to take care of patients in a pandemic for the reasons that we've already discussed, but we've said that that only applies where they have proper PPE. If they don't have proper protective gear, then indeed it may be prohibited for them to endanger themselves to take care of others. Not only that, but in the event that you say, well, I am going to take the risk for myself and take care of this patient, you have to recognize that if you indeed get sick, then you can't take care of other patients in the future. So you're weighing this patient against the many that you would hopefully take care of in the future. So my thinking on this is that they should delay, get the proper gear on, whatever the reasonable definition of proper gear is, and then in Rav Asher Weiss's presentation on this that I linked in the beginning of the source sheet, I heard him say the same thing. So Baruch Shekivanti, your protective gear has to come first. So Barry asks in the chat, where there is no PPE generally in a society, all Jewish physicians are not permitted to practice? I think that whatever the minimum definition in order to be considered reasonably safe, and I admit that that's a hard thing to say. What does reasonably safe mean? But I think the answer has to be that you're not allowed to endanger yourself, both in terms of your own life and in terms of the people who you would be able to take care of in the future. And I recognize, as Barry adds, sub-Saharan Africa in 3 months' time, I get the problem. But yes, I think that that's a very hard thing to justify. As I said in the beginning, I leave this for serious Poskim to give practical halakhic advice, but that's, I don't see a justification. I'm going to take one other question that's here in the chat before we move on. What if a healthcare worker has a halakhically legitimate or necessary reason for opting out of working in a coronavirus environment, but their departure, like the nursing home in Quebec, means that residents will be abandoned, unable to care for themselves, and basically left to die? So I think that's fundamentally just a more sentimental version of the way that we're already expressing it. I don't say sentimental in a negative way, but you know, as Lynn adds, if the doctor has a medical condition, are they able to say no to helping? I think the answer is still yes. And as terrible as I feel for the people who are left behind in that home in Quebec, if you have somebody who would be endangering themselves, again, it depends on the level of danger. If it's a low risk, then it's admirable / obligatory for them to stay on the job. But as the risk increases, it's less likely that we're going to expect this out of them. I think that's true. I see two other notes on here. One is the majority of cases of COVID, if they arrest, the chances of them being resuscitated is zero. We're going to talk about that, God willing. And then Albert says you find another way to help, which is a fair statement. Okay, I'm going to go on to the second vignette. Not because they've exhausted everything to say, but because it's 8:45. So let's go to the second one.